Welcome back, everyone, to the X-Cast. The truth is in here. This is Season 2, the beginning of our brand new journey into the next stage of the X-Files. I'm Tony Black, your host, back from the first season. There is no getting rid of me, and I am delighted to be joined by an all-new guest this week for our look at Little Green Men. It is Mr. Darren Mooney. Hello, sir.
Hello, pleasure to be here.
Pleasure is absolutely mine, I have to say. I have been, quite frankly, and I'm sorry to brown nose this early on, but I am in awe of the work that you do on your blog, which doesn't just cover the X-Files, but all kinds of other things like Star Trek and, you know, movies and all that kind of thing. Do you want to tell us a little bit about what you do? Because people need to see this stuff.
Well, thank you very much. Basically, I run a small Irish blog. It's called The Movie Blog. It's a wonderfully specific title. it's spelled with a zero as well, because the actual movie blog was taken when I registered the domain. But it's basically just a place where I ramble incoherently and extendedly about the popular culture that interests me. So The X-Files was part of that. I sort of did coverage for the 20th anniversary, which would have been 3 years ago, which is startling. It makes me feel very old.
Tell me about it.
So I sort of started doing that, and I sort of ran through a number of things, basically put that on speed, basically. When they announced the show was coming back, I was like, okay, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to cover the 9 years of the show as it exists at this point, the feature film, the comic books. I'm going to try and do all the extra stuff that various people involved did. So, for example, I tried to cover some of Space Above and Beyond, which was Glenn Morgan and Jim Wong during the third season. Millennium, which Carter did during the fourth, fifth, and sixth seasons. Even the later stuff like Harsh Realm and The Lone Gunman. And so I just tried to get a picture of the X-Files as it was through that. Because I think the X-Files is sort of fascinating as a cultural artifact, as a sort of a snapshot of the 90s. Mm. You know, was it the long 90s? I think that they call it the gap between, say, the fall of the Berlin Wall and 9/11 is typically used as the marker. The sort of the period of sustained peace and prosperity, where you had this sort of existential crisis of there is no external enemy on the scale of, say, Russia or the war on terror against which to define ourselves. So we have this sort of this philosophical debate about what it means, you know, to live in that context. Was it the end of history, to use Fukuyama's sort of somewhat exaggerated and perhaps outdated description of the period?
It's a fascinating idea, really. And, you know, I don't think we, you know, those of us who lived in the 90s, and I grew up in the 90s, I don't think we quite knew how good we had it, really. And the X-Files is a good example of that, yeah, that existential angst. So, yeah, I mean, what Darren's just described is the kind of in-depth, really interesting stuff that is on that blog. So do check it out, and we will mention it again later on in the show. Before we get started on the episode, though, we're going to go a little bit more in depth into your fandom by asking you the five questions of X, Darren. So hopefully this will give people a little bit of a taste of the kind of stuff that's in your blog, really. So firstly, let me ask you this. What is it that drew you in to the X-Files? Where did you find it?
I'm less than 30 years old. So I was actually too young when the show first came out to watch the early seasons. I first came to my attention around about the third season, which would have been when I was 10. And it was airing on Sky, because I'm like yourself, I live in the British Isles, I live in Ireland. So it would have been airing on Sky, which is the Fox television channel over here. And it was massively publicized on that. I think they'd stolen it from BBC, actually, which was quite remarkable. towards the BBC aired the first season on BBC Two, half of the second season on BBC Two, and then it became a breakout hit over here. So BBC moved it from BBC Two to BBC One, and they actually did it with the episode Humbug, which was really clever scheduling. And then sort of season three, Sky jumped in and sort of said, okay, this is very good, we should be airing this. And my parents wouldn't let me watch it at the time, so I would occasionally sneak up and watch it and stay up late when I shouldn't be. and actually, my first impression, this is a very embarrassing X-Files story.
Oh, good.
Yes, I know, these are the best kind of X-Files stories. The first episode I watched live, in the sense of the first time it aired on British television, was War of the Coprophages, which is the Darren Morgan script from the third season, which I know now is a comedy, but when I was 10 years old, there's the sequence where the teenagers are basically, and these are the characters who also appear in Mulder and Scully Meet the Weremonster, are basically snorting manure. Mm. I can't remember the name of what it was, but it was this thing that was this urban legend in the 90s. And it's obviously a joke about drug addiction and say that it's a really dark joke about the sensation of having insects crawling through your veins when you take heroin. Mm. But there's a sequence where one of the characters sniffing the drug, taking the drug, hallucinates cockroaches crawling through their veins. And as a 10-year-old, that scared the hell out of me. Obviously too young at the time to get that this was a very, very dark joke. And that sort of gave me nightmares for the next couple of weeks. And that was when Mom and Dad came down hard and banned watching The X-Files. But I sort of jumped on then around about the fifth season permanently when I was a bit older and a bit more mature. And sort of watched it through then. But it was kind of what appealed to me about The X-Files was I was introduced to like horror through my grandparents. So they'd sort of show me like the Hammer horror films and stuff like that when I was far too young to be watching that sort of thing.
Always the best way. Always the best time to discover it.
Yeah, grandparents are the best irresponsible babysitters you can have. And The Shining and stuff like that. And even stuff like Braveheart. They're very responsible for sort of shaping my cultural tastes. But The X-Files was the first thing that was sort of mine and mine alone, if that makes sense. It was the first thing that I watched that they didn't point me to, that I found by myself. Mm. And it's actually funny because they weren't huge fans of the show. My granddad actually really loved How the Ghost Stole Christmas. It's one of his favorite episodes of television ever, but he did not like the show otherwise.
it's a bit of an unusual episode, isn't it? So I suppose that makes sense.
It is. And I think if you want to know a lot about my granddad, there's everything you need to know about my granddad. He's basically Ed Asner from The Ghost Who Stole Christmas. But yeah, so that's sort of how I came to it. And I went back to it then on the 20th anniversary because I moved in with a roommate who also watched it as a child. And we were like, we should probably watch this and, you know, maybe see if it's as good as we remember it. And it really was. It holds up phenomenally well.
This is it. It's always interesting how people discover the show. And it's quite often when they have a childhood experience with it and they find something in it like that. So that doesn't surprise me, yeah. And War of the Cockroaches is a great episode to first see.
It is, even if I now see it completely differently than I saw it then. And I think I was too young to sort of get that it was a parody or a satire of sort of paranoia. I was like, this is really scary.
Well, speaking of episodes, the second question in the five questions of X is, what is your favourite episode of The X-Files?
That's a very, very tough question. I generally go with Never Again, the fourth season Glenn Morgan, James Wong episode.
We haven't had one before. That's great. Yeah, excellent.
Which is absolutely brilliant. It is probably my favourite episode of the show. It's the one that I go to, ironically enough, to introduce people to the show. And it tends to work quite well. It's very accessible. It's also it feels like a very personal episode of television as well. It feels very intimate and very sort of well-observed. And it was their last script for The X-Files before coming back for the final season, for the last season. And it taps into this sort of existential, like, what am I doing with my life sensation that you have, even if you've never met a man with a talking tattoo voiced by Jodie Foster. Which I think is what The X-Files does really well. It captures this sense of mood in a very melodramatic, heightened, like the universal scale sort of way, but it's very universal and common for people to have the sort of the sense of confusion and anxiety that Mulder and Scully experience. And I think Never Again just felt really clever and really personal to me.
It's memorable, isn't it? I mean, it's one of those episodes that if you've seen The X-Files, it will stick in your mind as a semi-standalone story, because obviously it's a big character thing for Scully and it ties into the mythology, but in some respects. But yeah, it is a memorable episode. And that it also has Rodney Rowland, doesn't it, who was he the lead in Space Above and Beyond, or he was one of the main characters, wasn't he?
He was a supporting character that sort of became one of the de facto leads. He was third billed in the credits originally, and then he sort of made the character his own, which is really good. He's the centerpiece of Who Monitors the Birds, which if you're going to watch one episode of Space Above and Beyond, well, you should really watch two. But if you're going to watch one, I would recommend Who Monitors the Birds, which is, I think, one of Joss Whedon's favorite episodes of television. Oh. It's told entirely, or it's not entirely, but it's told mostly through sort of silent extended sequences in which Rodney Rowland's character is sort of sent on a mission behind enemy lines. But there's no dialogue, there's very little dialogue to it. It's highly silent. It's very expressive in those terms. It's really, really good. And he is really, really good in it as well.
Yeah, yeah. He's a good actor when he does turn up in these things.
When he pops up.
When he pops up, yeah. Yeah, that's great. Never Again. That's a really interesting, interesting choice. What about your favourite season? Which one would you point to? Would it be season 4 where Never Again appears?
No, I think I like season four a bit less than most people seem to like season four, because I remember the highs of season four, but I also remember the lows, and I remember that's the season where you go from home to Teleco, which gives you a sort of a good indication of the variable quality of the season as a whole.
That's true. Yeah.
I would argue season three is the most consistent high-quality season. I think there are maybe two duds in it. Ironically, one of the duds is the first episode of the season, but I think that as a whole, the third season holds up remarkably well from beginning to end. And I think that as a monument of sort of what the X-Files can do, it showcases everything. It's got big mythology. It's got great standalones. It's got even the standalones that aren't regarded as memorable or classic. So stuff like Obediette, they're revealing and insightful of themselves. They sort of speak to what the show does very well. And then I also like season eight, but that's it will be my second favorite season, mainly because I think it gets a very hard time from fans.
Yeah, me too, actually. And I really, I'm one of the people who champion season eight as well, because I think on the whole it's great from pretty much from beginning to end. For me, without going into too much depth yet, it gets back to being scary, which the X-Files hadn't been for years.
Yeah, it's the most scary of the Los Angeles seasons by a considerable margin.
Yeah.
And it's also, I'd argue, and we're like 7 years ahead of the curve here, but it's also got this really cool three-act structure as well, which is remarkable for the X-Files. Because I think one of the problems people have with how Carter approached the show, and it came up again, I think, with the mini-season, is that Carter doesn't necessarily plan ahead a lot.
No kidding.
To put that diplomatically. And I think that with season eight, because of the conditions, without getting spoilery, because of the conditions that were imposed on it, the production team very clearly had to plan ahead and say, look, we have these resources available for these episodes, so we need to make sure that when we arrive at these episodes, the following elements are in place. Mm. And so you have a season that has a much clearer structure and a much better flow, and is, I would argue, end-to-end, the second best season in the X-Files.
I think I completely agree, actually. Season three as well is a really good a really good choice. Out of curiosity, what's the other dud apart from The Blessing Way?
I would argue Tessos Dos Pechos.
Good. that's the one I was thinking.
I don't think it's an underrated masterpiece or anything crazy like that. I'm pretty sure I'm missing another one in there somewhere. I don't like Swasigi as much as most people, but it's interesting enough that it gets by.
Yeah, it's a bit mad, isn't it?
And I love Hell Money. But we'll talk about that at some point.
Definitely, yeah, that'd be a good one to talk about. Hellman is an interesting one. But yeah, I'm glad you said that, Tessa Despicious, because I can't wait to get to doing that on this show.
It's
awful. Cool, okay. So the question then is, off the back of this, who is your favourite character? Now, as I always say when we do this, it doesn't have to be Mulder and Scully. It can be anybody. It could be recurring, one-off, whatever.
All right, well, in terms of my favourite character is probably, and I'm tempted to go for the recurring element here and go for Mr. X, who is just phenomenal and I think was sort of horribly underserved by fate and coincidence and chance and stuff. But he's just so fascinating, perhaps because you know so little about him. Like, with the other informants, like Deep Throat, he has this sort of paternal father thing going on with Mulder, and it's like he's like the idealized father, which is something that the X-Files returns to time and time again. The X-Files is sort of populated with father figures. So you can go, what flavor of father figure do I want today? Do I want, like, Deep Throat, Skinner, the cigarette-smoking man, everything? Whereas, and Covarrubias, I think, is too ambiguous in terms of who's she working for, who's she working against, and then she gets tied in with Krycek, who's just all over the map. Whereas Mr. X is like, you have no idea why he's doing what he's doing. You know that he doesn't really like what he's doing, both in terms of what he's doing for the government and what he's doing with Mulder. And you have no idea, like, as far as you're concerned over the course of the series, it could turn out that Mr. X is just really annoyed that he missed out on a promotion. Like, this is just his extended sort of, you know, F you back at the cigarette smoking man for passing him over on the project. He's like, okay, fine, I'm going to Mulder. I'm going to sort this out. You're going to have to deal with this mess. And I think there's this endearing ambiguity where you're like, you get the sense that Deep Throat is atoning for what he did. Like in EBE, he obviously talks about it. But with Mr. X, there's a sense that he serves nobody but his own interest. And Stephen Williams is just phenomenal in the role. And he gets what may be my favorite two-line exchange of the entire series. which is something that I've actually used and have gotten stink eye for using, which is after attending the opera in the middle of, I think it's a Colony or Endgame.
Yes.
Mulder approaches him in you know, black tie, asking, "How's the opera?" To which Mr. X responds, "Wonderful. I haven't slept this well in years."
it's a great one-liner, isn't it?
It's a fantastic one-liner. And he's really good. And I was really sad to see him go when he went, without getting spoilery.
Yeah. I mean, that's the great thing. You're right. That you never quite know. There are a few potential hints. One of which is in One Breath, which we'll get to, but you never really know exactly what's going on with X, and that's what makes him great, and what makes him edgy, and what makes him interesting, and he's very underused. You know, he doesn't appear all that much, so you never feel like he's overstayed his welcome, and when he does go, it's like, oh God, you know, it didn't feel like he necessarily needed to be the end for him. So he would be up there in my favourite characters, absolutely. Finally, then. If you could pick a moment from the entire show, from any episode, that you would say is your favourite, what first comes to mind?
I'm going to cheat and go back to Never Again here and just go to the closing scene of Never Again with the camera sort of pulling back from Mulder and Scully in that awkward sort of silence.
Oh, yes.
David Duchovny talked about, he was asked for like his defining, how he would end The X-Files. And he said, by the nature of the show, by the nature of television, it's unlikely that The X-Files will ever get a proper ending moment, because there will always be either more or the expectation of more, as I think the ending of My Struggle 2 demonstrated, you know?
Yes.
But I mean, even with The Truth, there was the expectation that there was going to be a film franchise, so it wasn't really an ending.
Mm.
So you have like this weird bit where you can pick iconic moments. For Duchovny, it was the closing sequence of the postmodern Prometheus, where the two of them are dancing and it goes onto a freeze frame. And you're like, that's where I would choose to leave The X-Files. For me, it's the scene of Mulder and Scully sort of sitting silently, realizing that their dynamic is probably not as healthy as they would have thought it was a couple of weeks ago. Yeah. And the camera's like, okay, we're going to leave them here. We're going to let them sort of work it out on their own terms. And I also, speaking of similar moments, it's the ending of Existence as well. Which is the 8th season, where there's a similar movement, where Mulder and Scully are having a private moment, and the camera sort of pulls back as if to say, okay, audience, this is what you get. This is where you leave Mulder and Scully. Of course it isn't, but I think it worked very well in that context.
I think that's a fantastic answer, actually, because it's one of those scenes that, even though Never Again is memorable, it's not necessarily memorable always for those moments. It's memorable for Jodie Foster and the tattoo and things like that. So things like that not necessarily get lost, but never immediately leap to mind as opposed to a lot of other scenes. And it is a fantastically written, well, a fantastic moment that isn't written. You know what I mean? It doesn't have dialogue. It's really dramatic in what it doesn't say.
Yeah, and it's conveyed so perfectly by the two leads, who are probably pound for pound the best casting of two leads on American television that I can think of.
Yeah, they're absolutely pitch perfect. If the day ever comes where they, well, I'll say if, when the day comes when they reboot The X-Files, when David and Gillian are too old, I am going to be one of those old guys who goes, no, you can't do this. You know, I'm going to be a miserable old guy going, it's not the same.
But isn't that the Mulder and Scully will still be doing this while David and Gillian are on Zimmer Frames argument?
Well, you'd hope so. They're not aging too badly, especially Gillian, you know. So.
Well, I look at Duchovny and Anderson, and I'm less than 30, and I'm thinking those are probably in better shape than I am.
Yeah, I know that feeling.
They play a more believable 30-year-old than I would.
Yeah, it's true. So hopefully we've got them for many years to come, but we'll see. We've got to get a season 11 first. But yeah, thank you for that. That's the 5 questions of X. That gives us a really good look at your fandom, Darren. So some great answers there. Let's get into the episode then. Let's discuss the season 2 premiere, Little Green Men. Little Green Men was the first episode of The X-Files, second season, and it first aired on September the 16th, 1994, is written by Glenn Morgan and James Wong, and directed by David Nutter. It sees Mulder, after The X-Files has been shut down, working surveillance until he gets a tip-off about a possible alien contact in Puerto Rico, and goes on a death-defying mission to uncover the truth.
Do you know this, Fox?
It's Bach. Brandenburg Concerto number 3.
2.
Good thing it wasn't a double jeopardy question.
Do you know the significance of this piece?
Well, recalling music appreciation with Professor Gans, Bach had a genius for polyphonic.
This is the first selection of music on the Voyager spacecraft. The first. 4.5 billion years from now, when the sun exhausts its fuel and swells to engulf the Earth, this expression will still be out there, traveling. 4.5 billion years. That is, if it's not intercepted first. Imagine, Fox, if another civilization out there were to hear this, they would think what a wonderful place the Earth must be. I would want this to be the first contact with another life form.
I know I've let you down. You've supported me at great risk to your reputation. And I realized that when they shut us down, there was nothing you could do. All I can say is I think we were close. To what? I don't know. What?
Do you like Bach, Mulder?
I live for Bach.
Then let's hear it again. I take it you're familiar with the high-resolution microwave survey.
They search for extraterrestrial radio signals. They shut it down.
You have to get to the radio telescope at Arecibo, Puerto Rico. I'll try to delay them as long as I can, but my guess is you'll have at least 24 hours. After that, I can no longer hold off the Blue Beret UFO retrieval team. And they have been authorized to display terminal force.
What am I looking for?
Contact.
Darren, then, out of 10, what would you rate Little Green Men?
I'm probably going to hedge here and say 8.5 or 9.
Okay. Okay. Why would you give it that?
Well, because I think it's brilliant. It's the second best premiere of the show's 10-season run, I would argue, behind only, say, Within at the 8th season. It's a very odd episode to come back on for the second season, coming out of like the Erlen Meyer flask, which is very much, I would argue the X-Files was better at doing cliffhangers and first-parters than it was at doing second-parters or season premieres. And I think that if you were to rank, like, if you rank the season finales, I think there'd be a lot of 10s. And I think you were to rank the season premieres, you'd get a lot of 6s and 7s, generally. Mm. And I think Little Green Men sort of upsets the expectations. So the Erlen Meyer flask closed on the X-Files being shut down, Mulder calling Scully and letting her know the information. And I think, as you guys mentioned on the podcast discussing the episode, there was some tension in, say, Fox, around them worried that people would think the show was cancelled and not coming back. And you get the sense going into the second season premiere, the thing to do would be to reopen the X-Files, to sort of to have an episode where Mulder and Scully find some proof, have a big adventure, and then everything's back in place for the, you know, for the second season as it goes. Now, that wasn't feasible for a number of reasons I'm sure we'll talk about in a second. But what you end up with is this really deeply personal, and despite the fact that it takes Mulder, like, to Puerto Rico, this sort of strangely intimate premiere that doesn't necessarily, it features a cigarette-smoking man, but it doesn't involve alien fetuses, it doesn't replace Deep Throat. It has a chase at the very end, but it's more tension than action. Mm. It doesn't have the sort of roller coaster feel that, say, the Erlen Meyer flask did. And I think that's a brave choice. I think it's a very personal personal script. I think it's a very sort of, it gets at the themes of the X-Files more than it gets at, say, the imagery or the iconography. It's like the truth is out there versus trust no one. This idea of whether or not the X-Files is paranoid or hopeful. Because I think that's one of the interesting questions to ask about the X-Files when you watch it. Is the X-Files a paranoid TV show, or is the X-Files a hopeful and weirdly optimistic TV show? And I think Little Green Men sort of touches on that.
Yeah, because, I mean, your instinct would be to say it was paranoid, wouldn't it? But in the end, there is that alternate, you know, hope that we can find the truth and that we can get the answers and everything like that. So a show that was completely cynical and paranoid wouldn't have a character like Mulder, I think, in many respects. So that's a really interesting point. I think I'd give Little Green Men an 8. I agree with you. I think it's terrific. When you said that about the premieres, I started rattling them off in my head and thinking, what are the good ones? And there aren't that many really great ones at all. So it would be up there. It might even be my favourite premiere. I think because it feels like a pilot. It feels like a second pilot almost. It reboots without rebooting at all. It really goes out of its way to reintroduce Mulder and Scully for anyone who hadn't necessarily seen the first season. And even though you obviously would be enriched by having seen that season, and it wouldn't make complete sense without seeing that season, I think you could start on season 2 and it almost feels like a sequel to what we've seen before. Yeah. And then the fact, like you say, that they don't immediately get them back in the status quo, and it takes them, you know, a good 8 episodes before they, you know, 8 or 9 episodes before they get back into that status quo. Admittedly, you know, because of external factors, but, you know, one hopes that they would have done that anyway, because it's a really interesting way of kicking off a really good season and having this premiere feel like something fresh immediately with fresh drama and fresh ideas.
Yeah, I mean, you're talking about this airing in September 1994, right? Mm. This is a time when television had largely, sort of primetime television, largely steered away from serialization and long-form storytelling. I think because of the failure of like soap operas, like Dynasty and Dallas and Dynasty, they didn't sell well in syndication in the 80s. So the networks were like, okay, we want television shows where everything is reset at the end so that we can sell it to syndication and they can air it at like 5 o'clock in the afternoon and people won't have to have watched the episode that came before in order to understand. So it needs to have a fixed premise and you need to get back to that at the end of every episode. So I think it's easy to undersell how radical the idea of going, okay, the X-Files are closed and they're staying closed is in terms of a television show called The X-Files in September 1994.
Yeah. You know, it was a brave move. It was a really brave move. The original idea for this episode wasn't to send Mulder to Puerto Rico, but apparently it was going to be that he go to Moscow. And Chris Carter was originally going to write the script, but then he offered it to Morgan and Wong, and they decided that he wouldn't go to Russia. Quite why he wanted to go to Russia isn't clear, but maybe he just liked the idea of, you know, trying to make Vancouver look like Russia, which wouldn't have been that easy to do because they do it later.
They do it in the fourth season.
They do, yeah. And in the end, Glenn Morgan took the idea from a feature film that he'd been trying to write, which was, he said, I'd written a script a long time ago on my own called Little Green Men that was about a guy who had gone down to a telescope in Chile. It was never made, but there were many elements that I liked. And then, so they basically tried to port that idea, but they did. They ported that idea into Mulder and then refashioned it for the X-Files. And they wanted to include something with the SETI background right from the first season and for Deep Throat. But it hadn't really gone beyond the discussion phase because they were interested in talking about how the government had shut down the SETI project. They even said they wanted to get school children to learn more about SETI and, you know, get a few more facts in there. And I think that's another thing it does really well. It manages to tie in to quite a few real-life, real-world ideas about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence and stuff like that, which I think gives it a little bit of an extra boost.
Yeah, I think you're right. And you mentioned there that like this developed from a screenplay that Morgan and Wong have been developing. And it's sort of some of the themes that they bring up here come up again in Space Above and Beyond. So, for example, they talk about the idea Senator Matheson has this moment where he's listening to, how do you feel about Bach? I live for Bach. And they're playing the Brandenburg Concerto number 2, which is a great moment. Senator Matheson has this moment where he talks about how it would be so great to imagine a universe where the first thing that aliens heard about mankind was the Brandenburg Concerto number 2 and what that would say about us and how they would imagine us. And it's something of a joke that Morgan and Wong return to in Space Above and Beyond, because they do a Christmas episode, of course, it being a Morgan and Wong show. And in that episode, they're traveling through space and they pick up a signal that's been bouncing around from Earth forever. And it's not the Brandenburg Concerto number 2. It's the theme song from Batman 1966.
That's even better.
It is even better. I would like to imagine what aliens would think of Earth if they listened to that. There's this sort of hopefulness, this idea that like what we're sending out into space is the best of ourselves. And I think that speaks, we were talking about the optimism, pessimism of the show, the cynicism of the show, that the idea that what we're sending up there represents the highest ideals of mankind. And it's very romantic, and it's very, like, there's something very beautiful in that. But I think the X-Files, we're saying, like, it seems cynical, but if you look at the taglines, the three taglines are trust no one, which is obviously incredibly paranoid, and it's something that Little Green Men plays with, because it's now the password to Mulder's computer, for example.
Yep.
And he gets really paranoid with Scully early in the episode. There's a sense that he's becoming unhinged. But then you also, on the other hand, you have that balanced against two other ones. I Want to Believe, which is, he includes in the opening sequence, it's We Want to Believe, or We Wanted to Believe, but the tools were taken away. And then you also have The Truth Is Out There, which is the belief that there is something better or something more magnificent waiting out there to be discovered, which I thought was really, really fantastic.
Senator Matheson may say there's no greater expression than Bach, but I think Batman, 60s Batman, is what I want us to be to be held to.
What mankind have sort of held up as a pinnacle of human culture.
Totally, totally. What's better than Batman? There's not much. So that'd be really good. Just to point out, and this is the first time we are putting this out on the show, and I'm stealing this from the Always Hold On to Smallville podcast. Hi, guys. The IMDb rating for the show is 8.3 out of 10 of collated reviews. So most people are on the same page as us, really, in terms of how they would give it a score. So on that note, let's go a bit deeper into Little Green Men and analyse the episode. So it begins with the teaser, which, as we've talked about, has the Mulder doing his first, one of his first ever voiceovers. In fact, it is his first ever voiceover, I think, that he would do to a lot of episodes going forward over the seasons. And it became a little bit of a Chris Carter crutch in some of the mythology episodes, where Mulder would do a nice little ramble for 2 minutes to fill out some time about something metaphysical or whatever. But I think in this case, it's a nice way of introducing the idea of Voyager and tying that into the idea of the signal being, you know, received at the end of the teaser. And it's a nice way of landing us back into the show, I thought.
Plus, it has a Bach soundtrack, which is really cool.
Yeah, it does, yeah.
It's funny you mentioning that idea of, like, this being something the show came back to. I think I was watching Little Green Men, and it's the first time I watched it since I watched it to review it, like, years ago. And it's amazing how much of what the show became, how many ideas that the show would come back to time and time again were sort of brought up in Little Green Men. Sort of, it seems to sort of lay out. So you have, obviously, you've got the voiceover at the start. You've got the idea of closing the X-Files and what Mulder and Scully do after that, which they come back to in the 6th season. You've got the idea of Mulder losing his faith along the way, which is something that they come back to in the 5th season. And you've got this idea, like, there's a line in the car park where Scully says, "Don't give up," which Carter incorporates into, obviously into I Want to Believe the film, but also into My Struggle 1 as well. So it's amazing how influential it is, even from the teaser.
It's true. It does lay a lot out there, doesn't it? And more than you think, which is surprising, really, because as I said, Carter allowed Morgan and Wong to write this, and it almost feels strange as to why he didn't. You know, as to why he didn't want to kick this off himself. Because there are plenty of touches that you would associate with Chris Carter. I mean, no doubt he gave it a polish, like he would give a lot of scripts a polish. But that is interesting, and because it does lay out all the themes he wanted to talk about.
But to Sasha, I think one of the things that's massively underrated about Carter as a showrunner is that he seems to be extremely generous and trusting of his writers. Like, if you look at the X-Files writing room, the X-Files writing room in the 90s is basically like an incubation chamber for like noughties television. So you had like people like Morgan and Wong, who would go on to create the Final Destination series and run Intruders and stuff like that. Darren Morgan, who's obviously one of the greatest television writers ever. Howard Gordon, who went on to sort of drive 24 and do Homeland. Vince Gilligan, who did obviously Breaking Bad and Better Call Saul, and even like Tim Maynor, who went on to Angel and stuff like that. Like, Carter invested a lot of trust in his writers, generally speaking, and gave them the freedom to do stuff like this, you know, to sort of to allow them to do what they wanted to do. And there's a sense that when you watch The X-Files, you can almost break it down into like 6 or 7 different shows based on the pet interests of the writers. It's not like a show today where there's one showrunner whose vision overrides the interests of everybody else on the staff, like David Chase on, say, The Sopranos or something like that. I think that you can say like there's a Vince Gilligan show almost that you can carve out, or there's a Glenn Morgan show or Jim Wong show that you can carve out. And I think that, yeah, giving the second season premiere, which is going to be a statement of purpose for the year ahead, and trusting that to not to yourself, not to the showrunner, not to the guy who's traditionally considered the visionary on staff, and giving that to two of your writers is a huge show of faith. And I think it pays off.
Yeah, it does. I mean, and I think if you're going to give, I mean, like you've mentioned all the great writers on the show, but if you were going to give it to anyone at that point, I think you would give it to Morgan and Wong, because they've done some of the best episodes of season one, hands down.
Yeah.
So it does make sense, really. But they do fine work, and it's full of really great written moments. I mean, one I love at the end of the teaser is where Mulder's finishing his voiceover, and he says, "Our voices have been silenced, our ears deaf to the realms of extreme possibility," at which point the transmission kicks in our receiver.
Yeah.
It's just a lovely moment, which then, you know, triggers Bach and the "I send greetings from the people of our planet" and all that stuff. It's great. It's just a really nice way of contradicting what he says and his loss of faith, which is effectively what this episode is about. He's losing faith in his mission, and a lot of the episode is about him rediscovering that.
Yeah, and it's such a great arc for Mulder that the show kind of comes back to it quite a bit in the years ahead.
But you would, I mean, if you were Mulder, you would
doubt.
You would doubt, and you would struggle because you keep being thwarted all the way through. And you know, that's something that is really encapsulated in one of the best ways in this entire episode, I think. When we get out of the teaser, we see Mulder for the first time, as opposed to hear him, and we see the new status quo. We get a few scenes that set up where Mulder and Scully are, and Mulder, of course, is doing really boring wiretaps.
He's listening to the lamest episode of The Sopranos ever.
Yeah, he really is. And he looks like desperately bored. He's got tons of sunflower seeds on the floor because he's been there that long in this little horrible little box room, listening to all these things that he's not interested in because the FBI are, you know, shunting him away. And then you've got Scully at Quantico, who is teaching again. She's showing students a lovely corpse and talking about it in a very human way. And I thought it even though it sets up the spooky gag at the end.
Yeah.
It's a very Scully moment where she actually says this man, he had all dreams and things like that. It's a very human thing for Scully to actually consider that as a person on that table, not just a body.
Yeah, which is something that I think is one of Scully's defining characteristics. I think that Mulder can occasionally be blind to the idea of humanity because he's so interested in something beyond it. And Scully's sort of very engaged with this idea of people being people. So like, I think Clyde Bruckman is probably the best example of that, if we're going to skip ahead. But you're talking about like the teaser in the first scene. One of the things I really like about Little Green Men, and it's mostly it's a craft thing, but it's the scene transitions that they do, right? So the closing shot of the teaser is the recording reel starting spinning as they listen to space. And the opening shot of the first act is the recording reel spinning as Mulder's listening to something more banal.
That's very true.
And there's a number of those clever transitions throughout. So you have like, you then go to the Watergate tape. So when Mulder's at the Watergate Hotel with Scully, you then cut to Mulder watching the Watergate transmissions as a kid to get ahead. But even in that, on television, watching the Watergate hearings, it's a shot of spinning tape reels again. So you have this iconography, this idea of sort of like, what would you rather be listening to on tape? Would you be listening to people talking about strip clubs while organizing financial scams like Mulder is? Would you listen to the collapse of sort of American faith in the presidency as they do with the Watergate hearings? Or would you want to turn that microphone somewhere beyond and listen and find something wonderful, something that sounds like Back from Outer Space, you know?
It's amazing.
And now I'm Back from Outer Space.
That's true. It's a great lot of symbolism and parallels and things like that. And I think the fact that Mulder and Scully meet in the Watergate Hotel car park is wonderful in itself.
$4 an hour for parking. That's criminal.
it's a really good scene with Mulder and Scully, because obviously he blanks her in the corridor and she says good afternoon, and he just blank. And you know, at the time you'd think, oh, it's classic Mulder being rude, but there is the element of, he later says, you know, we must assume we're being watched, you know, we can't be seen talking to each other because we've been shut down and it's dangerous.
One of the things I really like about Little Green Men is the sense that, like, Mulder has sort of gone off the deep end a little bit and become overly paranoid. So, like, during the conversation in the car park, Scully's like, I doubled back, I checked, I wasn't followed. And Mulder's like, these people are so good that you will never know if you're being followed. And then later on, ironically, Scully is followed, and it's by the two most inept agents you could ever imagine.
Terrible, so aren't they?
They really are. It's like, let's walk towards her. Uh-oh, she's turning, what do we do? Panic, freeze. Make sure I show her my wire in my ear.
let's dress like tourists, but not you know,
but act like tourists.
That's something that happens on the X-Files all the time. The people who are working for the conspiracy are really obviously really bad at spying. It's quite a comical thread all the way through.
There's a suggestion throughout the X-Files that, like, the conspiracy is comically terribly organized. Like, they have no solution, and it's only the well-manicured man. You get the sense the well-manicured man brings this up in meetings. Like, the conspiracy, when something bad happens, the immediate solution is, okay, kill everybody involved. They really don't have a setting beyond that. And sort of, like, I like this idea that Mulder is somehow overestimating them, in that he's like, look, if they were following you, you'd have no idea. And you're like, no, you probably might suspect it.
But you see, it makes sense that he would be this paranoid for several reasons. Obviously, he doesn't do well without Scully. And if there's any, like, run of the show that proves this, it's this first, like, few episodes, especially when she's kidnapped and abducted. He doesn't work well without her because he doesn't have anyone to balance him and temper him. So he is getting sucked into this paranoid abyss even more. But it is that, you know, after what happened to Deep Throat and after coming, you know, I mean, we talk about this in the Earl and Maya Flask episode, but how close he got to all of the truth in that episode, you know, in terms of the mythology and what he actually was saying, was enormous. And so when Deep Throat dies, it's that real shock to his system. And then when the X-Files is closed down, that, you know, it could all end immediately. Yeah. And these people, you know, will just clamp down on you. And he's been beaten down a bit. So he's in that space where he is paranoid and he is overestimating and he's losing touch with what he's doing. And I think what I loved about it more than anything is the way Scully just turns around and he says, well, what do you want? She says, just to see you're okay. Yeah. You know, she hasn't called him because she's got a case, or she just wants to know he's all right, which is lovely.
Which, and I think it also speaks to what we were talking about there a moment ago about Scully seeing the human side of things while Mulder looking beyond. You know, Mulder's first statement on arriving at the car park isn't, it's good to see you. It's asked, what information have you got? Even in a jokey way, it's like, what have you got? Tell me what you've got. And Scully's like, actually, we should probably, like, talk like people.
Yeah.
You know, you probably should talk to somebody, and I guess that's me. One of the things that's interesting about Little Green Men to me, watching it, and it's particularly obvious in the car park sequence, is, like, the early second season makes it very clear that the X-Files is not really about the X-Files. The X-Files is about Mulder and Scully, and I don't mean that in a shipper way, although, because that's going to open a can of worms.
Yeah.
But I mean, the idea that if you could take out the X-Files from the X-Files, so Mulder and Scully technically aren't working on the X-Files together until, like, later in the season. The show is still the show as long as Mulder and Scully have each other. And, like, Morgan and Wong have come out and said they're not shippers. And I think, like, Never Again makes a very clear case that they don't think the relationship is entirely healthy. But time and again, Little Green Men returns this idea that Mulder, as long as Mulder has Scully, he has something he can hold on to and something that can ground him and something that can center him. And he even says it, like, repeatedly over the course of the episode, like, I can only trust you. Or at the end, I still have you. Or when he's ranting on the phone, sorry, on the little speakerphone, saying they've taken you away from me. Like, there's a sense that Mulder and Scully, as long as Mulder and Scully have each other, the X-Files being closed is an inconvenience. Like, if this had happened to Mulder a year before the pilot, say, you get the sense he may have been driven to a psychiatric institute or something darker than that. But at least now he has Scully, she can give him something and sort of, like, she can support him almost, which is, you know, which is remarkable. I think that sort of, you can understand why shipping became such a thing and why the show focused on the Mulder and Scully relationship. And I think it happens here, really.
It does, I think. It really starts to kick off. And, you know, there are some, it just proves that she's his rock. You know, he even says in that conversation, you know, I need evidence, not just theories. I learned that from you. You know, and it's a lovely moment because he has, you know, a woman who could have come in and just debunked his work and just, you know, ruined him. He's somebody,
has made him stronger.
Yeah, has made him. And he says it. I think in the movie Fight the Future, he says, "You made me a whole person." And it's something that all the way through is that she is the other side of him that he needs. And not even completely in the romantic sense, you know, and that's something that is just an extra. It's not even really about that. And that's the great thing about it. And even the way that this scene then transitions into the flashback, as you mentioned before, is excellent because it's, you know, it's got that Watergate connection going back to the 70s. And then it has the famous scene of Mulder remembering Samantha's abduction. Now, this is something that's really interesting, I think, this scene, because all the way through the show, there is this question as to whether or not Mulder remembers what happened to Samantha accurately. You know, one of the really good episodes of season 4, Paper Hearts, really does put the seed of doubt in your mind as to what happened to her. You know, it's with the whole idea of her potentially being abducted by a murderer. And then later on, we find out that maybe her, you know, her life and her death wasn't quite as alien as it seemed. Now, I've always wondered if his recollection that we see here isn't really accurate. You know, he even says to Scully, "I'm doubting what happened to Samantha." Yeah. And on this recollection, this very sort of, you know, playing a game, then suddenly aliens come in, you know, blasting through the window, and then she gets sucked through the window in a very sci-fi Close Encounters kind of way, and screaming "fucks" and all that. It just seems almost like a construct in his mind that he's created in order to find a way to understand and see. I've always doubted as to whether or not that's actually what happened.
Well, I mean, there is, to get all continuity nerd on you, it does conflict slightly with the version of events as outlined in, say, the pilot and Conjuring, which I think was accidental on the part of Morgan and Wong.
Yeah.
But it does sort of generate this idea of, there's this recurring theme of the X-Files, this idea of memory and how memory is distorted and bent and misshapen. And I mean, like, you mentioned Paper Hearts playing with this idea that Samantha wasn't abducted. Vince Gilligan does it again in Unusual Suspects, which is a really, like, if you look at it, it's a really blackly comic episode about how Mulder was exposed to, like, a nerve agent a couple of weeks before he first remembered Samantha being abducted. So you're like, okay, maybe his memory isn't what he thinks it is.
Yeah. And this could be an example of that. I mean, obviously, I think from a creative point of view, Morgan and Wong are trying to tie in that vision of the alien in the door with what he sees in Arecibo.
And it's very well structured as well, because even the shot of, like, the fuse blowing, for example, like the fuse blows in the house before the aliens arrive, and then the fuse blows in the observatory before they arrive. And then you have stuff like Mulder reaching for his father's gun, but not getting there in the flashback in the house. Mm. And then he actually draws his gun successfully in the abduction sequence later on. But I mean, even the colouring and shading, like the reds and the blues, which look really, really stunning, by the way.
Yeah, they do. It is brilliantly shot all round, you know, in terms of lighting and colour and, you know, staging. I thought the young lad who played young Mulder was really good as well. He even had David Duchovny's mannerisms, like the slightly shrugging shoulders as he walks, and it was just very well put together as a piece and quite creepy.
I love the idea that Mulder was not watching Watergate because Mulder was paranoid or sort of conspiratorial at that point in time. He was just watching it because it happened to be on before the magician was coming on. Which is, I really like that idea that Mulder's life was so derailed by what happened, the loss of his sister, that he was a normal kid growing up, that it wasn't like, he didn't always believe in aliens. He didn't always mistrust the government.
No.
This thing happened and this, like, derailed his life so spectacularly.
He obviously then goes, once the flashback's over, into the heart of government, and he goes to see Senator Richard Matheson, who is a really interesting scene for loads of reasons. The first one being that right from the very beginning of the show, he talked about having connections in Congress, and that was never completely followed up on all through season one. So it's great that they went back to that and they said, well, if Mulder's actually, if his work has been championed by somebody with a bit of power, what's that about? You know, who is this person? So introducing a character like a senator who actually is batting for him secretly is and who basically is one of the people who set up Mulder on in, you know, kind of in the X-Files and kind of gave him a little bit of flexibility and maybe put a bit of pressure on the FBI, I think is a story that I've always wanted to see more of, actually. And I've always wanted to know a little bit about how he found Mulder and what place he had in the conspiracy.
And also sort of how completely useless he turns out to be once things sort of, once things heat up, once Mulder actually starts finding stuff, all of a sudden he ceases to be of any use protecting Mulder at all.
Yeah, he does, even though he's, you know, seemingly quite a powerful government figure.
Yeah.
He was originally supposed to be played by Darren McGavin, who played Kolchak.
Kolchak.
Yeah, in the original Kolchak the Night Stalker, which we talk about in the primer episode of the X-Cast as being a major touchstone influence of Chris Carter. And they'd been trying to get Darren McGavin on forever. And they, you know, he was supposed to be Mulder's father, and it didn't work out until season 5 or 6 when they finally got him in as Arthur Dales. But
the father of the X-Files rather than the father of Mulder.
Basically, yeah.
He also plays the father of Frank Black, which is Chris Carter's other major character as well.
He does. In terms of millennium continuity with the X-Files, you have to kind of sort of worry.
There are a lot of people who look very similar.
Yeah, we don't worry
it's
about
a
that.
Small world, yeah.
Terry O'Quinn playing about 5 different people in X-Files canon. but yeah, Raymond J. Barry is a great actor in this, and I think he brings a real sense of character to Matheson, even though we see him about 3 times in the entire, you know, 10 years, and he only gets maybe one or two scenes each time. Yeah. He really imbues Matheson, who, of course, he's another little note. He's named after Richard Matheson, the famous author, as well. So there's lots of little in jokes. But I think he's a really fascinating character, and I think the way this scene plays out with then the using Bach and as a disguise for the actual real conversation they're having, it's just really cleverly done.
And what I like about Matheson just as a character is the sense that, unlike, say, Mulder's other semi-father figures like Deep Throat or the cigarette-smoking man, the sense that Matheson is sort of, at this point, now later on he does get more involved, but at this point he's far removed from the conspiracy and all this sort of stuff. This is like an interest to him. This is like a pet project. It's not his life. Yeah. You get the sense that it's just like, oh, somebody passed him on. He's like, oh, I know a guy who can deal with that. He can do that in his own time. Which I really liked about it.
That is an interesting way of looking at it, actually, yeah. And it makes sense in the context of Matheson's not quite having the same place in the conspiracy as everybody else that we see. All these much more shadowy figures who don't have names, you know, and don't have exact positions. He's a man with a name, with a job, you know, you can
find.
It's
like Sender Matheson's primary interest is healthcare, but he's also a little interested in aliens.
He was also originally supposed to narrate the episode, the monologue, at the beginning, Matheson, but it was changed to Mulder, which I think makes much more sense.
It does, although I do like Raymond J. Barry.
Yeah.
I really like it. He has this sort of authority and air about him, which I think
he does.
Might have worked okay. But Duchovny sells it very, very well.
He does. His voice would have been actually quite nice as well. Yeah, yeah, true. It would have worked, I think, but it makes more sense to Mulder. But then after this, as Matheson tells Mulder that, you know, points him to Arecibo and says, contact, in a really nice little way at the end. I love that. Then we're back at the FBI, and we've got a brief moment that reintroduces Skinner and the Smoking Man when they were, you know, a buddy duo back in the early days when they used to hang together, and they're keeping tabs, as Mulder has suspected. But what I love about these early scenes between Skinner and Smoking Man is the one-upmanship that keeps happening between them. And it's just really subtle, but it's done in things like, you know, Smoking Man pulling out a cigarette and Skinner going, nuh-uh, pointing to the little sign that says, don't smoke.
Yeah. Or the cigarette smoking man acknowledging the sign, sticking the cigarette in his mouth, lighting it, puffing on it, and then walking out the door as if to say, I'm doing this because I want to, not because you told me to.
I'm the boss here, mate. Yes.
or even like the little scene, and I think it's in this episode, where he opens up the cigarettes and they're empty.
Yeah,
and he's like, have you got a top-up? And Skinner's like, I don't smoke.
Yeah.
And it just works so well. I think those two actors play very well off each other, Mitch Pileggi and William B. Davis.
Yeah, it's great. They really do. They don't have to say much in order to have that little, you know, chemistry going on, and that lovely little belligerence in the Smoking Man as well. It's making them more into characters, which over the first few episodes, they really fashion much more into characters as opposed to the archetypes that they were. But yeah, obviously, so we know that they're watching Mulder and they're trying to keep tabs on what he's doing. And then Mulder's off, and he's off to Puerto Rico. And I've got to say, I think...
Vancouver as Puerto Rico.
Yeah, they do such a good job here, I think, of actually recreating somewhere so different from the landscape of Canada, the Canadian seaboard. It's like they do. This is a great example of when they really somehow manage to make you believe you are in South America, I think.
I'm not entirely convinced by that. I think I appreciate the ambition of it. I think it's fantastic for the show that was on say the budget that it was on. But I think there's stuff that you can't disguise. Like the foliage is still very clearly Vancouver foliage, despite the sound of crickets playing loudly over the or the sound check of mosquitoes, and like a little bit of fence that Mulder can just walk around. Apparently, but I might have the ambition of it, but I think this is at the point where, like, I think in the third season the show's budget goes up significantly, or even towards the end of the second, and they get much better at that sort of conveying a sense of place. Like, I think in Piper Maru they do an excellent job of Hong Kong in Vancouver, and I think in the fourth season they do an excellent job of Russia. I think Puerto Rico, it's not entirely convincing. it's sort of like, you know, like in Magnum PI where they shot in Hawaii.
Yeah.
And Hawaii always had to be, like, when they were shooting the Vietnam flashbacks, it was always Hawaii. And they make little efforts. And you appreciate the work that they did on the budget and the time that they had. But it sort of, it didn't seem quite right. It's not quite, was it EBE that has, like, Vancouver as the Iraq-Turkey border?
Yeah, that's yeah, that's really bad. No, yeah. It's true. I suppose it doesn't quite completely work. I've always been sold, though. I think what it is that I've always kind of, you know, found it believable to an extent.
Yeah.
But they do a decent job.
They do a fantastic job.
Yeah.
Vancouver is the third credited lead on the show.
Absolutely. One day I will do a pilgrimage to there, and I will go round and find all the places that are in the show. But while Mulder's obviously there, and he's. He's looking for Arecibo and looking for the place. Scully is he's playing a very interesting game all through this because, admittedly, her foes in the conspiracy are not difficult to combat because they are all very dim. But but after she hacks the password, and it's obviously Trust No One, which we mentioned earlier, she nicely plays dim in feeding Mulder's fish to the...
That is a very deft maneuver.
Yeah, very brilliant, you know, where she gets the paper and she, you know, she screws it up, very cleverly puts it up her arm.
While wearing, like, the trench coat that Gillian Anderson wears throughout the episode to disguise her pregnancy, even when apparently in Puerto Rico.
Yeah, it's true.
I've never been to Puerto Rico, but I imagine that the temperature and humidity do not encourage the wearing of heavy-duty trench coats.
You wouldn't need your FBI coat, would you, there? Absolutely
not. No, I love the juxtaposition of Mulder in a sort of a sleeveless sort of tank top shirt. And sort of Scully in, like, her heavy Vancouver wear.
It's true. Yeah, and this is where you have to go, yeah, they were disguising a few things.
They were hiding things. And they did a very good job, to be fair.
They did. One thing that did strike me odd about this scene was when Scully first gets to his apartment and she plays the voicemail, there's a woman on the end who says that Mulder hounded her for lunch and then he didn't show
you're
up.
You're a pig.
Yeah, you're a pig. And I was like, I've always gone... That's surely not Mulder. That doesn't sound like him.
Yeah, it doesn't at all. And it's like it's really weird that sort of by the time the show very clearly moves past that to the point where in the sixth season, one of the things that clues Scully into the idea that Mulder isn't Mulder in Dreamland Part 2 is the fact that he is hounding women for lunch acting like a pig.
Yeah.
So it is a very strange... That sort of struck me as well when I heard that on the voicemail. Like, Morgan and Wong, they introduced the idea of Mulder being interested in pornography as well. So it seems like a very strange touch to have him be, you know, both into pornography, which became sort of like a showcase for how dysfunctional Mulder is and how much difficulty he has relating to women. And then also have him successfully ask women out to lunch that he, you know... Admittedly, ditching them to go to Puerto Rico is a very Mulder move. And perhaps that's why he gets less dates as the show goes on.
I almost wonder if that was a studio note to sort of say...
Oh, well, make Mulder sexy.
Yeah, yeah. Put a bit of sex in there. Have a hint that he's got a sex life and that he's not this, you know, model-looking man who has no sex life because nobody's going to believe that. But, well, we will because he's Mulder.
Because Duchovny is actually a very good actor despite being incredibly handsome.
Yeah, exactly. But it didn't quite work. But, you know, you can let it go.
You're a pig was a very 90s sort of, like, it was a very 90s phone message.
You're a pig! Yeah, I think they go for slightly ruder word.
Yeah.
If it was done these days. But then we're in. We get a bunch of scenes where Mulder's finds Arecibo at the Arecibo base, and he's sweating like a pig, frankly, by that point.
Which is a great touch. Again, that's another example of the show's like the careful production that they have.
Yeah, I think again that's an example of what sells me to it. You know, yeah. It makes me feel like he's actually there. I did think, though, would he not, you know, he's been there for a fair while now. Would he have not surely have gone for a wee earlier and then found Jorge Concepcion, right? Because he's been...
That's what I was thinking, I wasn't thinking the exact same thing when I watched the episode. I was thinking more like, how long has Jorge been sitting in the bathroom listening to somebody walking around outside, pressing buttons and speaking to himself?
It's unusual. Surely he would have, like... You know, peered his head out the door.
Stuck his head out, yeah.
Yeah, it's odd.
That does lead to a really nice sequence where the two of them have difficulty communicating across language.
Yeah.
And Jorge responds by drawing an alien face on the wall, which is very much like the Voyager engraving, the idea that you communicate through images as well as through music and art, which I thought was a really nice sort of structural element.
Yeah, it's great, that kind of thing. It really is. It mythologizes the aliens even more and gives it much more of a... Yeah, that element of, you know, this unknown arcane knowledge just inscribed through your images. It's excellent. And I love the fact they feel the need to put subtitles on what Jorge's saying as well. That it's, you know, because you'd think that would have been a note to say, well, why can't we understand him? But that's the point, in that, you know, we get enough from his manic, you know, and raising voices. And, you know, we know that he's seen aliens or something like that and he's scared to death. That's, you can pick that up from his, ultimately. Yeah, it's a really good scene, actually. It gets a lot across there.
One of the touches I like during those sequences is the idea that Mulder has lost all sense of time and date. Mm. So, like, there's the scene when he does, after he does find Jorge, where he's recording into the microphone, which I think is a very, like, he's trying to emulate Scully's style.
Yeah.
But he's like, I found the body on, and then there's a pause, and there's a sense that Mulder has actually forgotten what day it is. And he's like, 10:15.
Yeah.
Which I really like the idea that Mulder is so crazy and so devoted to all this. Plus, he didn't bring a change of clothes, that he's completely lost in what he's doing.
Yeah, definitely. It's funny you mention about that. When later on, when he's talking into the dictaphone, after Jorge has been frozen to death outside, when he does a runner, and he's a bit terrified, not only does Duchovny play it really sort of breathless and exhausted as to where he is, but also it's like he's trying to be Scully at the same time. When he's doing the autopsy around Jorge, it is that sense that
this is what Scully would do.
Yeah, and it's like he's having the conversation that he would normally have had with Scully when they were doing cases with himself and asking those now rhetorical questions about, you know, what's doubting things and what's going on, what would I do, what's this, you know. And when he'd normally get Scully go, well, hang on a minute, what about this, this doesn't make sense, he still needs her, so he uses that self, you know, that dictaphone in order to have that conversation with himself. And it just shows how important that is to him now, to have that dialogue, and that when he doesn't, he struggles. But before that, you've got Scully still doing her investigation. She finds out about the WOW signal, which is a real thing, as it turns out. Something that actually did happen in the 70s, where there was a signal received from, it seems, outer space. And I don't think they've ever quite figured out what it is, but it was unusual. And they tie that in nicely to the episode. And did you notice the little wink when she looks at the passenger manifest as well? There was a name on there that I recognised. Like, they always do this, usually shows. Apart from George Hale, which is the Mulder's...
The astronomer from... the story earlier
from
on,
the story,
which is his cover,
which is the story about the elf climbing into the window, which he talks about Scully.
Yeah.
There's the name Charles Grant, who is a writer and a novelist who wrote some X-Files tie-in novels, and I think he may have written an episode of the show as well, or contributed. Yeah, and I clocked that. I was like, Charles Grant, very good.
I believe that the names on the manifest were also possibly names of fans as well, which is something that they do quite regularly, and they did it. Particularly, obviously, in the ninth season, where the opening scenes would include, the title sequence would include the names of fans who posted online.
I did,
which is, I think, not a very nice touch.
That is, and I did wonder, actually, as I was watching this, I was thinking, I wonder if there aren't any of those names leap out at people. So yeah, that makes sense. They're very good at that. But obviously, then Scully is continuing to do her spy bit at the airport. We've talked about her hapless conspiracy tailors, just wearing some of the most I mentioned it earlier, but they're wearing...
Stereotypical touristy.
Oh, it's hilarious. You know, they couldn't look more like tourists trying to be tourists who aren't actually tourists if they tried. But I like the way she uses her foundation mirror to do a bit of spy
sleuthing.
Work. Yeah, and a bit of, okay, let's have a look around. She's very good. She's very good at throwing them off the scent here.
Yeah. Like, I like the phone call to Mulder's answering machine, knowing that it was bugged, or that they were listening in, which was also a very clever way of throwing them off.
Really clever. And it's the kind of things that Scully's now picked up. She wouldn't, when we met her 24 episodes ago, she would never have thought to do that. She's learnt that now through being with Mulder and through what they've seen and through the nefarious people they've encountered. So it's good development for her, really. And then basically we get to the point where Mulder, it all kicks off in Arecibo. Mulder's on his own. He's starting to question, and he says, "What would I do if they really came?" And then on,
they really come,
almost on cue, actually. Ta-da! We're here.
You ran.
And obviously, you know, there is the parallel to Mulder's, you know, memory of Samantha with the same kind of noises, the same, you know, colours, the same lights, suggesting that it's the same force that he remembers taking his sister who appears here. Which is intentional, obviously. But the question is well, I was left actually thinking, because after this happens, the first moment we see is Scully with the torchlight shining in his face as he wakes up. And I did think, did he really see any of that?
So you mean, did Mulder have a giant freak out where he thrashed the room?
Yeah.
And sort of woke up and went, I saw aliens.
Yeah. And did, much like the actual, you know, the memory of Samantha, which may not be as clear as it seems and may be, you know, a collection of all kinds of alien things that he's seen or he's heard about or he's, you know, he's read about. Could this have been a moment where he had some sort of episode based on the stress and the pressure and everything and he doesn't see any, and then that torchlight is almost the light that he thought he saw. I don't know if you got that, but there's nothing in the episode that directly says it's that, but it did make me wonder.
But there's also, the episode is also very careful to ensure that there's nothing in the episode that proves Mulder saw what he thought he saw.
Yeah, exactly.
The episode is very conspicuously careful to make sure that there's nothing supernatural about the death of Vorhei.
No.
There's nothing on the tape recording. There's nothing on the printout that he can grab to take with him to prove that it happened. And I think one of the things I like about the episode is the suggestion that it doesn't really matter then.
Yeah.
Like, that, as long as Mulder has faith, it's the faith itself that's important.
Yeah, absolutely. That's right. It's not that he has to get something from this. And, you know, obviously at the end when they find the tape doesn't have anything on it, Scully makes the very clear point that it could have been an electrical surge that did it. There was a storm. It's a very, very rational explanation. Sometimes Scully's rational explanations are a bit more far-fetched than Mulder's, but in this case...
One of the things that I like about that is, though, that it's a Scully rational explanation that serves to back up Mulder. Like, it's Scully trying to reassure Mulder that it's entirely possible that he did see something. Mm. Like, usually Scully makes these crazy theories to disprove Mulder, where Mulder's like, it's obviously a liver-eating fluke man, and Scully's like, no, it could just be a serial killer. And it's like, okay, you're wrong, Mulder, is the subtext there. Here, it's like, Mulder's like, I swear I saw aliens, but the tape is blank. And Scully's like, well, maybe you did see aliens and the tape was wiped.
Yeah, that's true, Yeah, she does. And because he needs that, doesn't he, at this point?
Yeah.
He needs her to be there and to, you know, to give him that push and to say, don't stop, you know, stop being who you are.
Because there's something really sad. Well, we're skipping ahead, but we'll talk about it when we get to the closing scene. But there's something very sad in that closing scene between Mulder and Scully.
Mm.
Where it's just like where she reaches out and touches his hand and they sort of, and she can't even like look at him in the eye.
Mm.
Like she feels so, so bad and so sort of sorry. I don't know if it's sorry for him, but she does feel like this incredible sort of empathy for what he's been through.
Yeah, I think she does. I think that's true.
Yeah.
Before we get there though, just quickly, we have the chase sequence where they escape then. Scully gets, you know, she makes the point, the Blue Beret UFO retrieval team, who have been authorized to display terminal force, as Matheson says, in my terrible impression of him. They're turning up to kill anyone who's at the site. And
But they're kind of half-hearted. Like, they get down the bottom of the hill, and the car is in the distance, and they're like, ah, feck it.
Yeah, don't worry about it.
Yeah, that's it. If anybody asks, there was nobody here when we arrived.
Yeah, exactly. Would they not have had more than one, like, truck, or more than one car, or something to go after them? They're not that far away. You know,
or even like set up a perimeter to borrow 24 parlance.
Exactly. Set up a roadblock at such and such. Yeah. They should.
Yeah. Yeah, like maybe lock the gates before we go up there. Secure the environment.
Yeah.
People generally don't wait around for us to shoot them. Surprisingly,
It's weird. Again, yeah. Inept conspiracy people. Yeah. Really, maybe they're just so confident that no one's ever going to like get away with anything or challenge them that they can't be asked. They're just very much like, oh, it's fine, which probably is a little bit of truth in that. But it's a good. Quite pulse-pounding chase sequence, I thought. You know, it's well executed. It really... what I like about this is that, you know, in a lot of the time in The X-Files, the reason that Mulder manages to survive is that you've got quite a lot of people turning around and going, oh, we can't kill him because of his crusade, or we can't kill him because of this. They would have killed him. You know, yes. I love that. I love the fact that they very nearly get shot. And it's yeah. great.
And the scene of, like, Mulder and Scully sort of driving away in this sort of, this really old family wagon car as well.
Yeah. Yeah, just make a desperate escape. It's a good sequence. And then we're back at the FBI, and Mulder's getting chewed out by Skinner for leaving his really thrilling wiretap assignment to go off and hunt aliens. But Mulder this time, you know, he does stand up to him, and he says, you know, you've been surveilling me. It's bogus anyway what you're getting me to do. And the scene nicely wrong-foots you, because up until this point, Skinner has firmly been in Smoky Man's little lap. And you firmly think that he's just going to get bollocked and Smoking Man.
Yeah.
And then when Smoking Man decides to get a bit cocky and you know, chew him out himself, Skinner goes, oi, this is my office. Get the hell out.
It's not even that. The way the scene is shot is fantastic, because you have, like, you have when Mulder mentions the wiretap, you have this wonderful shot of Skinner looking at the cigarette Smoking Man as if to say, I didn't realize that you did that. And then you have Skinner saying, get out. And there's a pause where it's like Mulder and the cigarette smoking man both look up and they're like, okay, which one of us is he talking to?
That's true, actually, yeah.
and then sort of Skinner says, like, get the hell out. It's like, okay.
And Smoking Man does that sort of double take as if to say, you're talking to me?
Yeah. But he's right over there. You're making eye contact with the wrong guy.
But then he still, again, he does that belligerence, doesn't he? Where he yeah. lights up a cigarette and he stubs, you know, he's still
which
making
is wasteful.
The point. Yeah.
No wonder the guy is short on cigarettes earlier in the episode if he keeps doing it for dramatic purposes.
Yeah, you ought to think of that, shouldn't he? But then it's just a really nice moment that, you know, for the first time, Skinner becomes more than just the hard-ass boss, you know.
Yeah.
He becomes the guy who isn't going to take too much, you know. It's his domain, it's his turf. Much as he is, to some extent, in the pocket of Smoky Man, he's not completely in that guy's pocket. And he will, to an extent, defend Mulder where he can. And I like that. And especially then when he turns around and says, get back to your job. You know, he doesn't give Mulder anything more. He just says, go back to the surveillance.
We still need more, even though you've already told me that you have enough to arrest these guys.
Yeah. You're not going to get too much out of me. You're still going to play this part for now, because this is your punishment. Yeah. But it's just really good. And then it tees up when we really see Skinner properly fleshed out in one breath. In a few episodes, where he really comes into his own as a character even more. It's a great moment. And it's a really good moment for the Smoky Man as well. It's the first point we start to see him speak more and, you know, show that element of character. It's just great.
Yeah. Which I think is amazing. As you sort of mentioned last year, it's the idea that they had no idea if the cigarette smoking man could act.
Yeah. Well, yeah. Absolutely. He was...
just, your job is to smoke a cigarette.
Yeah, you know? Yeah. And look... enigmatic.
Look menacing. Yeah.
But yeah, and then we go into that final scene, which we've talked about a little bit, about, you know, Mulder hearing the tape and hearing nothing on it, and Scully touching his hand and everything, and that sadness. But that lovely moment where he says, you know, I've got you, I've got myself, you know, I've got enough. I've realised I've still got enough to keep going. And then you get that brilliant last shot, just as you get a really nice variant on the Mark Snow theme. You get a lovely shot of Mulder just listening at the tape. Just possessed, just listening. And that's just, if there's any image of Mulder I think is perfect, it's him just listening at a tape like he's waiting for something.
Yeah.
And I just think that's a beautiful, visually, it just sums the guy up for me.
Waiting and hoping, knowing it's blank, but hoping that it's not.
Yeah, exactly, yeah. As a way to open up a season, I think it's just a really strong episode, because it manages to tell a single story on its own. It's got a lot of thematic resonance, it's got a lot of ABC, a beginning and end almost within its own little package, while spinning off all the different, you know, things that they're going to follow up on the season, and not wrapping it up, you know, like you said earlier, not getting them back on the X-Files, not Skinner turning around at the end of that confrontation with the Smoking Man and saying, I'm opening up the X-Files, Mulder, you're back. You know?
It's like you never left.
Exactly. And they
could we'll never speak of this again.
They could have done that. They could have cheated and just sort of gone, oh, let's reset the button a bit. And then the host onwards, it's normal. But they don't.
Yeah.
And that's... And that's, I think that's brilliant.
And ironically, it's something they kind of do in the Revival miniseries a little bit, is they do sort of hit that reset button pretty hard, where it's like, Mulder, I need you to come back into the office. By the way, next week, you'll be acting as if you were never off the X-Files.
Yep, and don't worry about the fact that, you know, our evil super soldier aliens want you dead in the FBI. Forget that. We need you back.
or the fact that you're wanted for, like, the murder of God knows what... commendated military officer had been sentenced to death by the U.S. government.
Noel Rohr. So, yeah.
Yeah. Which, best Chris Carter name ever.
It's a great name. Noel Rohr.
He was on the shortlist of my favorite characters just based on the name.
It's a great name. Where did he come up with that? Oh, amazing.
The entire tape is blank.
You know, an electrical surge in the outlet during the storm may have degaussed everything, erasing the entire tape. You still have nothing.
I may not have the X-Files, Scully, but I still have my work. I still have you. Myself.
Next up, we're going to move on, and I'm going to ask you, Darren, do you believe him? Which is the element of the show where we talk a little bit about the paranormality that's been going on, if we believe it in it in real life. So, bearing in mind the wow signal,
which actually exists
in this episode, do you believe that we have ever been contacted by extraterrestrial life?
You probably get this a lot, but I'm going to say I want to believe.
Very good.
But no, I believe, statistically speaking, in the infinite vastness of the universe and the galaxy, there has got to be life somewhere else. But I also believe that given how vast space is, which is something that we don't really deal with in science fiction very often, how incredibly vast and empty the universe is, relatively speaking. And I'm not talking about life, I'm talking about objects. The idea that we would ever actually come into contact with something else seems highly statistically unlikely. And I find myself questioning and unable to believe or invest in the idea that we have been contacted in the past, that we are being contacted in the moment, and that the sporadic indications of contact that we had, say the wow signal, are not just flukes, equipment failures, highly improbable events happening in space rather than the work of an intelligent design, almost. Sorry, that's a very pessimistic answer. There is life in the universe, but the universe is so vast we will never know.
We'll never find it. It's like No Man's Sky, the new video game. We're never going to know. We're never going to find.
We'll never bump into anyone.
But that's a logical, reasonable assumption. You know, in that is more likely the truth, which is why something like the wow signal deserves a wow. And the wow signal, just to go into a little bit more detail, if you want to look into it, it happened on August 15th, 1977. It's described a little bit in Little Green Men, but not in too much depth. And it was a strong narrowband radio signal received by the Big Ear Radio Telescope at Ohio State University. And it appeared to come from the constellation Sagittarius. Astronomer Jerry Ehrman discovered the signal a few days later. And while reviewing the data, he was so impressed that he circled wow on the comments, which is how it's since been referred to. It lasted for 72 seconds, and it's never been detected since. Various hypotheses on the source of it have been put forward. Although the possibility of a natural origin has not been discounted, to date it's considered the best candidate ever received for an alien radio transmission. Now, given the fact that majority of these things are quite, you know, comprehensively debunked pretty fast, the fact that 40 years later, the wave signal still, it's a case of it might be aliens.
It's still fascinating. People still speculate about it. I mean, even earlier this year, there was speculation that it could be a result of the signal bouncing off two comets that were only discovered in the past 10 years. Now, scientists say that that wouldn't account for the sound that came out, but the fact that people are still asking and people are still debating it and still discussing it is fascinating.
It's exciting. It is fascinating and it's exciting. Yeah. And, you know, if we ever do get contacted by an alien civilization, it will be a momentous day. Who knows? I mean, you know, it is a possibility, and it might have happened, but
it just seems odd that it will be the only indication.
Yeah.
Sorry, Darren Rooney, pessimist. I'm very much like early Mulder in the episode, not like late Mulder.
No. You haven't...
I feel like I need to go to Puerto Rico and have like a spiritual encounter and have my faith renewed.
Or Vancouver, more accurately.
Or Vancouver. Vancouver as Puerto Rico.
So next up, we're going to do the final bit of the episode, which is the X quiz. And this is the bit that always stumps people quite often, and everyone just hates me afterwards because it's five questions and a quote based on details from Little Green Men. So we currently number one on the leaderboard is Andrew Brooker, who got for 6 out of 6 for, I think the episode was Lazarus. So whoa. Yeah, he did very well on Lazarus.
I repressed the memory of Lazarus, I'm going to be honest with you. Well, like, I can't imagine retaining the information long enough to answer questions on it.
He did the most I've never known anyone do more notes than Brooker did for that. It was he must have spent about 5 days just putting things together,
just watching it over and over and over again until he can quote it back verbatim.
He did, bless him, and he did very well. Are you ready then, Darren, to face the X quiz on Little Green Men?
I am indeed. Go.
Okay. Apologies in advance. Question one. Okay. What was the name of the first term Nevada senator who terminated the SETI project, as Mulder talks about in the teaser?
Bryant, I think. No?
Yeah, Richard Bryant. Yeah, Richard Bryant. I'll give you that. Yeah, Richard Bryant.
Yay!
Well done.
Sympathy point.
Off the grid. Excellent. Question two. What's the wiretap number we see on screen when Mulder first appears in the hotel? This is difficult. Hold on. This is difficult.
I'm going to pass. There goes my perfect 6 out of 6.
Okay, well, you'll kick yourself because it's the very easy to guess. Hashtag 5A21147. And you didn't at all need to pause the episode right that
to
day.
To catch that. No. Damn it. It's funny. It was just going to roll off my tongue.
No, strange. I'm disappointed you didn't get that one. Not question three. How far away from Deep Throat's funeral did Mulder attend with a telescopic lens?
I am also... Hold on. 1,000 yards?
1,000 yards. Well done. Yeah, excellent. Which is the closest he was able to get.
Actually, yeah, just, I know we're going to derail the quiz. I was sort of wondering, if Mulder attended the funeral, right? Mm. Does that mean he knows Deep Throat's name? Because we find out later on that it might be Ronald, or it might not be Ronald.
Yeah. Well, you know, it crossed my mind. It's crossed my mind before. How did he find him?
Yeah. Like you kind of imagine if you're touring, like, the Washington Post obituaries. Yeah. It's not like, you know, Ronald Dworkin was killed today while involved in an alien trade-off of an alien embryo. He is remembered by his associates for his participation in a conspiracy against mankind. Yeah,
that would be the greatest biography ever. That's what obituary. Obituary. That's what I want mine to be in the paper. Yeah. Maybe
there was a photo.
Maybe he did. Maybe he did do that. Maybe he did scan the obituaries and then found a killing that was essentially the same, and decided, knowing Mulder, he'd have gone to all the funerals just to be on the safe side. You never know.
Jesus, no wonder he's paranoid or sort of depressed at the end. I've been attending the funerals of all, like, you know, 50 to 60-year-old men who died in service over the past 3 months.
Yeah, he's got a rock and roll life, Mulder. So, question four, then. You got that one. Which is the... Now, this is not quite a trick question, but which is the Brandenburg Concerto which Mulder guesses to Matheson, but he's wrong? Oh,
I remember this. Mulder guesses 3, but it's actually 2.
Well done, yeah. I can't give you a net bonus point for...
damn it!
...for that.
I would have made the perfect score.
Yeah, you would have done. You would have got it. Very good. Question five. Can you name the telescope that NASA was working out of in California that the SETI astronomer mentions to Scully?
Gladstone. Likely, right?
Goldstone, yep.
Goldstone, sorry.
Goldstone, I'll give you that. It's close enough. Goldstone, okay. Yeah. Goldstone Observatory, which is, I'm presuming...
I knew it wasn't Griffith.
That would have been a bit too obvious, wouldn't it, really? Okay, so the final question is a quote, and... you'll probably guess this one, actually, because the quotes are always really easy because I always forget all the good quotes all the way through. So, okay, just give me the character and the scene, if you can. So, whenever he's away, I feed his fish.
Oh, that's Scully basically pocketing the what the goons consider to be the computer test printout, but what is actually the flight details, isn't
it? Yeah, that's it, yeah. Yes.
Feeding the fish.
Absolutely, feeding the fish. And they say to her, just pour it all in. She goes, that'd be...
that's bad for the bad fish, for the isn't fish. It?
Do you evil conspiracy men do not care about the fish? How dare you?
Surprisingly. it's a very sensitive soul to be involved in that sort of conspiracy, I think.
It's true. It is true, yeah. You have to be. You have to care for fish. So yeah. After the... after that, you've scored 5 out of 6. That's very good. You almost got full marks there. Excellent for your first episode.
Despite not freezing the frame and noting down the wiretap number.
Rookie error, Darren. You'll know for next time.
It's a learning experience.
So yeah, that brings us to the end of the season 2 premiere of the X-Cast Talking Little Green Men. It's been an absolute joy to have Darren guest with me this time round. And you'll be back in a few weeks' time, won't you? So
really looking forward to it.
Absolutely, yeah, it'll be great. Until then, where can we find you online?
You can find me on the movie blog, which is spelt as it sounds, except there's a zero instead of a VI. I occasionally podcast with an Irish website called Scan On, which is Irish for film. And I occasionally write for the Irish news media thing, thejournal.ie. I'm also hoping to have a book published by the end of the year on the X-Files, which should be very nice.
Wow, fantastic. Tell us a bit more about that.
It's still in the developmental phases. So I've written it and I've sent it off to the company that are looking at it. And they're basically just putting it together basically at the moment. So I'm hoping that it'll work out. And they've expressed interest in they're pushing ahead with it as far as they're concerned. But I don't have a date yet.
Well, keep us posted because we'll do a lot of promotion for that. That's fantastic.
I've been very lucky. I mean, Camille Nanjiani, who hosts another X-Files podcast, actually has volunteered. He did the intro for it, which is very nice.
Wow,
as well.
That's amazing. That's brilliant.
It is. And also, yes, I should probably lead with he hosts another X-Files podcast and actually appeared on the show.
Yes, he did.
Just to bury the lead there.
He got so famous with his X-Files podcast that they let him be in Mulder and Scully Meet the Weird Monster as the baddie. Yeah. So
spoiler.
Yeah, spoiler, sorry. But that's fantastic. Well, the best of luck with that, and I really hope we get to talk about it on the X-Cast a little bit down the line. Until we return, you can find us at the X_cast on Twitter. Please do hit us up, add us, talk to us. We're on Facebook at the X-Cast as well. Talk to us about anything X-Files related. It'd be awesome if you did. If you could also leave us a review on iTunes, that'd be amazing, because then we'll get to be even more famous and get people listening, which would be lovely as we go into this second season exploration. And if you really want to follow me, I'm at Mr_AJ_Black. On Twitter, so you can look me up there. Yeah, big thanks again, Darren, for joining me.
My pleasure.
And thank you very much. And we'll be back very soon to look at The Host, which is a nice, creepy episode with the Fluke Man, one of the best. One of the best villains ever.
And the most memorable.
Yes, yeah. Absolutely. So, and a fun little bit of business for this episode. We have a new theme tune, as you'll have seen at the very beginning of the hour. This isn't me trying to cobble together Uncle anymore. This is actually... a whole new theme tune we've had created by a talented artist known as Will A on Twitter. And you can find him at I Am Will A. That's I Am Will A-Y-E. And he makes music and he's open for collaborations. And a really talented guy who's created a really, really cool theme tune after I put out a request. So huge thanks to Will, and his music will be featuring throughout the second season and beyond. And also big thanks to Creatures Tricks on Twitter, also known as 70 CEVNNI, who will be appearing on the podcast next year. And he created his own themes, which were really good. And it was a really, really difficult decision to actually choose which one was going to be the X-Cast theme. So we're going to play you out today with an example of the kind of stuff that 70, or I think his name is Kevin. but we'll find that out soon next year that he put together. So, yeah, we'll be back next time. And until then, remember the immortal words, trust no one.